Let's change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, this is Mickey Desai. I'm your host for this episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. Very happy to be talking with Carrie O'Brien today. Carrie's an employment lawyer and labor policy consultant. You there, Carrie?
Yes. Hello, Mickey.
Glad to have you today. And today we're going to talk about employment law and as it relates to nonprofits, I think. Isn't that right?
Yes.
I see in your notes, you sent me your background. You've done a lot of things in the nonprofit sector. You've been a founder, a director. You've done a lot of different stuff. So I'll hand the ball off to you and get us running there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me, Mickey, and hello to all nonprofit Snapcast listeners. Because I've been working in employment law for the last 20 years, what I've learned is that employment law in the U.S. is pretty harsh. For example, in the United States is dead last out of 71 countries in how easy it is to fire somebody. And so what I've noticed in nonprofits is that they often will use a consultant or a local pro bono lawyer to do their employee handbook, and we'll often get advice to just basically meet the minimum of U.S. law. And, you know, in doing that, it occurred to me that nonprofits may not even know that they're, you know, sort of having these policies that are quite at the bottom of what's available to workers around the world, and as a result may not be living their values and may be communicating mixed messages that can contribute to employee disengagement and turnover.
Okay, now that's interesting. Before we do the deep dig in there, I have to put out one devil's advocate statement on the table, which we may edit out later, but that is, I have a lot of conservative friends who say that the whole at-will phenomenon that we have here in Georgia, for instance, actually improves productivity and actually improves the quality of work that people can produce, because it makes things more competitive and it favors the employer. And to damage that damages productivity. What do you think about that?
You know, employment at will, you know, the United States is the only industrialized nation to have employment at will. You know, somehow all other industrialized countries, you know, the UK, Australia, et cetera, you know, are being productive despite mm-hmm. having some protection for somebody before they could lose their job. And, you know, I would argue that as nonprofits, you know, we are out there in the world asking the world to be different. We are asking the world to be more compassionate. We are, you know, we're raising up the voices of people who are poor, of the environment, and so forth and so on. And, you know, that's just part of what's going on in our sector. And, you know, to say that, you know, what employment at will says literally from the court cases is you can be fired for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all. And it's really harsh if you take a step back and think mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most nonprofits, you know, don't really live by that. They try to have a reason. Most nonprofits have some kind of process for documenting problems and so forth. But ultimately, the law says that you don't need any reason at all. And, you know, is that really in line with the nonprofit's value, supposedly where its employees are its most valuable asset?
Right. And that's right. And I would venture a guess that a lot of nonprofits don't actually know that the law should be, I'm going to use this phrase, should be changed or could be changed. You know, I think that a lot of us grow up thinking this is simply the way it is.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, just as an example, most nonprofits where I've worked or have worked with offer a series of paid holidays, you know, some Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, you know, some are more generous, the 13, you know, federal holidays, and some, you know, additional local holidays. Well, just right there, any nonprofit that does that is providing benefits above and beyond what the law requires. Only in Massachusetts and Rhode Island are paid holidays a requirement.
Wow.
And so, you know, and most people don't know that. Most people do think that there is a federal law or state law requiring paid holidays, but there absolutely is not. You know, and it's just another kind of indication of the relative harshness of employment law in the United States. And so, you know, any nonprofit that gives paid holidays is already being countercultural and is doing something to live out its values.
Right.
And so the message that I'm trying to bring to nonprofits is, let's take a look at all your policies and everything that you're telling your employees about what you value and what you don't value, and see if you can't bring your employee handbook and your policies and your practices more in line with your values and perhaps get a better result overall.
Right. Okay. So what kind of policies are we talking about? What sort of changes to an employee handbook do you usually look at?
You know, one thing would be to create a real grievance process. That would be to allow employees a forum to dispute and challenge negative reviews, demotions, suspensions, or firings. And especially in a large nonprofit, this can be a blessing and an early alert system for senior leaders to any brewing problems in a particular department or with a particular senior leader. Okay. And that would be, I would say, kind of a baby step towards ending at-will employment, would be just to tie yourself to a grievance process. But you could go ahead and just end at-will employment altogether in your nonprofit and just say that all terminations will be for just cause only. And then you can describe, you know, some of the things that you consider to be just cause.
Let's go back a half a step here. And you know, you said tie the termination of at-will to a grievance process. Is that how you phrased it?
A grievance process could be just a baby step. It wouldn't mm-hmm. necessarily be ending at-will employment. A nonprofit could basically retain all its rights to fire somebody at any time for any reason, but still have a grievance process. Mm-hmm. Or a more advanced step would be to end at-will employment altogether in your nonprofit.
Okay, got it. I see. So the grievance process at least gives the employee a voice in the termination proceedings.
Exactly. And it also allows, you could allow a grievance process for other things that happened before the termination. For example, a demotion, a negative review, and, you know, bring all the issues out before it got to the seriousness of a termination, which is much more likely to bring your nonprofit a lawsuit.
I see. Okay.
Another thing that you could do is to enact a severance policy. The United States is also one of the few nations where there is no required severance in the event of a layoff. And as we know, many nonprofits run through difficult financial times for various reasons. And, you know, some form of mass layoff or, you know, at least a layoff of more than a couple of people is necessary from time to time in nonprofits. So to have there's no legal requirement for severance pay, meaning, you know, a right. payment to help make the transition in a layoff better, and people will just have to rely on the unemployment system, which, you know, have we seen through this pandemic, is in many, many states is very inadequate with very small maximum benefit amounts in the, you know, $300 a week.
Right.
And so that's really not going to be a successful transition for your employees. And by implementing a severance policy, then you are demonstrating your values to your accountant and to your board and your accountant then needs to take that into account. You know, it is a financial liability and an obligation, but you'll need to take that into account when making decisions about what, when, and how to do your layoffs. Right. And I would argue that having a policy in place like that ahead of time before the bad times will help you to live your values in the bad times.
Doesn't that just, I mean, again, I'm taking a sort of a devil's advocate position here, but doesn't that sort of change the culture of employment altogether if I, as an employer, hire somebody with the knowledge that I need to keep cash on hand in order to pay severance for this person if they ever get fired? What does that do to the employment landscape?
So just to be clear, severance is really about a layoff. Severance is generally not paid in the case of a just cause firing.
I see. Okay.
If you want to, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not about, oh, hey, you know, it's not a challenge to your employees. You know, see how badly you can act and I'm going to give you 4 weeks pay when I fire you. No, it's more in the case of, you know, which is not an unusual circumstance in a nonprofit where there needs to be a layoff. A department closes, a program closes, a grant ends. You know, 10% it's decided to cut 10% of personnel, et cetera, and there's a layoff through no fault of the employee's own, but you are basically just offering a financial cushion, which could also include an extension of health insurance and other types of things that will make a transition in this type of circumstance easier for the employee and place less burden on the social systems that we all are trying to uphold and support, you know, right. like food stamps and the unemployment system and so forth and so on.
Right, right. I get it. Okay. So, all right. So grievance process, severance pay policy, which again, I think does, I mean, you know, layoffs are not something that we can really adequately predict for. So how does that, I mean, I guess that changes at least the fundraising picture for a nonprofit in order to be able to keep something in reserve for severance pay if conditions get bad enough to warrant layoffs. Isn't, I mean, would that not be an accurate statement?
Absolutely. I mean, if you take, for example, your IT contractor, let's say you're in a contract with the, you know, a legitimate ironclad contract for, you know, $75,000 this year. When you, when you're having financial problems, your accountant, your lawyer, and your board is going to advise you as a executive director or senior leader, well, nope, we can't cut the IT contract because, you know, that would be breach of contract. But hey, you know, employment law in the U.S. is so free and easy, just fire this person over here and you'll get your, you know, and you'll have your money. And really, you know, is that really how it should be? So why not make a pre-commitment to your employees that if you lay them off, you know, you're going to provide some form of severance. And I think what it will really do is just force boards and senior leaders to take action sooner and not just kind of wait until, you know, so to speak, the hurricane hits and lay people off quickly. You know, and you know, I've been part of it. And then there's a lot of palace intrigue in the nonprofit and, you know, the previously warm relations between senior leaders and line employees become very strained because there's a lot of secrecy. Whereas if there's just a commitment ahead of time that, you know, X, you know, an example policy would be 1 week of pay for every year on the job, and, you know, up to a maximum. And, you know, if that's in writing and everybody knows about it, it lessens the anxiety for the employees, but also forces the nonprofit to confront financial problems sooner.
Right. And well, and it also simply eventually becomes just another element of preparedness.
Exactly.
Right. All right. So good. What else can nonprofits do?
Well, I've seen some employee handbooks recently coming out of HR consultant shops that are often crafted for like a widget factory type of a situation. And so they have a lot of what I would call industrial era clauses about, and they go into great detail about starting time, ending time, and breaks. And I would just encourage all nonprofit leaders to pull out their employee handbook, as well as employees, you know, pull out their handbook and take a look and see, see if you have a lot of detailed things in there about basically controlling people's time and where they are and what they're doing. And consider whether your nonprofit who's primary output is probably human output, you know, the things that people are doing, the care that they're offering, the advice that they're offering, the food pantry that's being run, you know, it's the humans that are making your product and making you successful at what you're doing. And do you really need all of that control? And right. Think about taking those clauses out and leaving a little bit more discretion to your employees rather than signaling to them in the employee handbook that they are but a widget.
Right. Exactly. Let people be people.
Yes.
I mean, that sounds kind of simplistic. And I admit I have my own rant on the topic that goes all the way down to, you know, we should probably also do away with things like dress codes, which are discriminatory in some cases, or things like that. You know, I think that there's a huge, I mean, that's a huge HR rant, which we probably should not get into for the purpose of this, of this podcast, but I'm right with you. Yeah, I agree. And I didn't think of those things as industrial era clauses that are outdated. It just, again, to me, that just seems like things that you're used to seeing because they've always been there.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's been one of the advantages to me of, you know, working and representing workers for the last 20 years is really, you know, realizing how and you know how harsh U.S. employment law is. Mm-hmm. And it got me to, so that's what got me to thinking about, well, you know, maybe nonprofits need to hear more about this, so that they can be sure that their policies are living their values and not just the minimum of whatever U.S. employment mm-hmm. law requires of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. So it sounds like there's some, I mean, all these changes can be affected at a policy level and can actually be put in writing. What else should nonprofits look at as long as they're changing their employment practices?
Well, I think then, you know, making your employee handbook a living document and mm-hmm. making sure that you're, because in most places where I've worked and that I've worked with, you know, the employee handbook is a document that is, you know, given, potentially signed to acknowledge at the first date of hire and then never spoken of again. Whereas, you know, if you've put some care into the document and you believe that it reflects your values, you know, make it a living document, make it something that is part of your organizational culture, you know, discuss a section of it at a staff meeting, train your senior leaders on it. Very, very, very important to let them know, you know, what are the values of the organization, because, you know, people are going to have come in having gone to different HR seminars, come from the private sector where, you know, HR seminars in my experience are extremely compliance focused and just focused on, you know, and are focused on, you know, the minimum that US law requires, as well as, you know, lawsuit avoidance, and not necessarily on using policies to get the most out of employee engagement and so forth and so on.
Right. So I have to ask, you talked about employment culture, or at least the organizational culture. You know those giant posters that they have in the break room?
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know anybody maybe besides me who's ever actually read them. Do you?
I don't. I also have read them, but I absolutely, I don't think so. And, you know, over the years, you know, and I don't want to be so dismissive of U.S. employment law, because there have been major strides
sure.
with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the Americans with Disabilities Act, and, you know, we're getting there on sick leave and so forth and so on. But in a way, because there are so many laws and then there are so many exceptions to those laws, the posters have to be like very small size. And then there's a whole cottage industry of people that, you know, get all the posters, all the required posters onto one poster, which makes it even more difficult.
So,
I don't think this poster in the break room is necessarily a good solution. And one thing that I do recommend to my clients is to take those posters and, you know, and put them into your employee handbook, as well as, you know, incorporate them into your training, and, you know, making them part of a living document and living part of your organization, and not just stuck on the wall in right. 9-point font.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, which brings me to another rant, kind of, which I have been known to say that an HR department doesn't serve the employee as much as it serves the employer, and you know, is there mostly to protect the employer from the employee? Is that not a fair? Would you say that's not a fair statement? And then would you say, what can HR departments do to make everything we've talked about easier for the employee?
I think that is a very fair statement, and I think it is that HR departments serve the employer and not the employee, but I think they, you know, a lot of times they pretend to serve the employee, which creates a lot of confusion and really a lot of anger once an employee realizes that's not the case. And in my experience, nothing gets you a lawsuit faster than anger.
Sure.
I have seen employees, you know, fights all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, completely against their detriment, you know, using up lots of time and resources because they just cannot, they feel so angry of a legitimate injustice that was done to them. And a lot of that can just be avoided by not making people angry in the first place. And one way to do that is just to be upfront about what HR is. There's a fabulous consultant out there named Paula Brantner, who advises all of her clients to, or she advocates for, HR is for limited functions of payroll and those types of things. Mm-hmm. And that anything having to do with investigations into any type of sexual harassment or race discrimination or anything like that is handled by an outside independent firm that specializes in that, that can do a truly non-impartial investigation and then advise management as to the next steps.
Interesting. I like it.
So that would be a really good way for a nonprofit to live its values, to have a system like that in place.
Right. Like a third party ombudsman, if such a thing could exist.
Exactly. Oh, it absolutely exists. Mm-hmm. And those types of services are absolutely available, you know, and in the end could be a lot less expensive than litigation, making settlement payments, and just the general upheaval that comes from, from that type of disruption to a nonprofit.
Right. Exactly. All right, so I'm going to summarize here. We've talked about employers can commit to a real grievance process so that you don't need the harsh at will disclaimer anymore. Nonprofits can think about putting in a severance pay policy in place, like an automatic thing that kicks in if a layoff should have to occur. Get the industrial era clauses out of your handbook. Let people be people. Let's see here. We've said make the handbook a living document and list within it the things that HR can do or that the organization can do for the employee. What else would you add to that list?
I would limit the ways in which you can search personal property and computers and explicitly allow company equipment to be used for reasonable personal use. And then consider other ways that you could go beyond the minimum amount that US law requires, like for your employees who are entitled to overtime, could you give double time instead of 1.5 times pay? Could you give overtime or bonuses for exempt employees who work a lot of hours? Mm-hmm. Tackle that work-life balance issue that we all struggle with. Paid family leave, and even consider implementing a 4-day week, maybe even just starting out a 4-day week in the summer.
Yep, absolutely. Again, another personal rant of mine, but we need to hang out more often.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
It's encouraging for me to hear you say these things, and I hope that more nonprofits can really put some thought behind living their values in this way and actually increasing, because if I'm reading you correctly, what you're talking about is improving the quality of life for everybody involved. And it's not
absolutely.
Just...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There is certainly, you know, I'm sure that this will hit many nonprofit leaders as, expensive and risky. But I would argue that it is expensive and risky not to do these things and to just go along with the standard employee handbook, which no matter what you say to your employees about how valuable they are, that employee handbook may say otherwise.
Right.
And that can be expensive and risky in the long run.
Carrie, this is lovely stuff, but we are rapidly running out of time. If a listener wanted to ask you any questions or be in touch with you, how would you suggest they go about doing that?
The best way to get in touch with me is through LinkedIn or Twitter, where I'm O'Brien K2, O-B-R-I-E-N K2 on both platforms.
Okay, got it. Thank you. And thank you for making the time to do this recording with me today.
Thank you, Mickey, and thank you to the Nonprofit Snapcast.
To our listeners, thank you as always for joining us. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating via whatever mechanism you use to listen to the Snapcast. Your 5-star ratings make us more findable by search engines, and we are grateful to you for helping us grow our audience. In the meantime, we'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.